from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forum's opening hour, Chicago School Superintendent Arne Duncan is President-elect Barack Obama's choice for Secretary of Education. Duncan had a hand in drawing up Obama's education platform. We'll round out the rough draft with your suggestions by phone and email. Then in our second half hour, we'll talk about Obama's call for a Craigslist for service with Craig himself, Craig Newmark, taking good intentions from online discussion boards out to the community. All that's coming up next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to Forum. Here's President-elect Barack Obama talking earlier this morning about his pick for Education Secretary. We'll have that clip in a minute. Arne Duncan is the man. Who is he? What's the platform? Joining us on the phone to talk about both are Martin West, Assistant Professor of Education at Brown University and an Executive Editor of Education Next Organization. Thank you, Martin.
Glad to be here.
And Bruce Fuller, Professor of Education and Public Policy at UC Berkeley, as well as Director of the Policy Analysis for California Education, or PACE. Thank you, Professor.
Good morning.
Well, Arne Duncan, who wants to start in talking about who he is? Bruce Fuller?
Well, I think in part he's a mirror image of Barack Obama in terms of style. He's known for pulling a lot of parties around the table and trying to hammer out a consensus. He seems to be a solid pick in that regard. And on substance, he seems to share the president-elect's rhetoric, at least in terms of wanting to experiment. He has a modest merit pay program to reward teachers whose students are more effective. So in many ways, he looks a lot like the president-elect on style and substance.
Martin West, we'll get to you in just a second, but I did want to play a clip of Barack Obama talking about that vision for education.
We need a new vision for the 21st century education system, one where we aren't just supporting existing schools, but spurring innovation, where we're not just investing more money, but demanding more reform, where parents take responsibility for their children's success, where we're recruiting, retaining, and rewarding an army of new teachers, where we hold our schools, teachers, and government accountable for results, and where we expect all our children not only to graduate high school, but to graduate from college and to get a good-paying job.
Martin West, those all sound like things everybody from all sides of the political spectrum would agree on. But do you see a platform plan to make those things happen?
Well, it's difficult to know at this point. Bruce Fuller is exactly right to point out the fact that Arne Duncan does appear to be a consensus candidate. In particular, he appears to be well-positioned to bridge a divide that has emerged within the Democratic Party between those who support more aggressive attempts to reform schools, especially in urban areas, and those that have called for the government to pay more attention to the out-of-school factors that play into a lack of student success, particularly students in disadvantaged backgrounds. Arne Duncan has endorsed statements that have been intended to call policymakers' attention to both of those areas, and so I think he's well-positioned to bridge that divide. The other thing that's interesting about Arne Duncan's appointment is that he is the superintendent of a large urban district. This is the same thing we saw with President Bush, with his first Secretary of Education, Rod Page, and it marks a shift from the Secretaries of Education before Page, Richard Riley under Clinton and Lamar Alexander under the first President Bush, who were both governors. And I think you're seeing a shift here in the attention of education policy from the state level to urban school districts and really concentrating attention on those areas.
And you say that even though the Bush administration established No Child Left Behind, and that actually is coming up for a reauthorization vote.
Sure. That is going to be the key issue that the Obama administration is going to have to deal with, what to do with No Child Left Behind. It's something that received very little attention during the presidential election, and it's an area where Arne Duncan's positions are not entirely clear. He has a reputation of being very pro-accountability. In Chicago, he's maintained policies that retain students in grades based on their test scores. He's provided a wealth of information about school performance on the department's website. He's used that information to close down some schools. And so a lot of his thinking seems to be in line with No Child Left Behind, with its emphasis on test-based accountability. He's also, though, been a proponent of more flexibility for districts when it comes to implementing the law. He had a battle with the Bush administration, with Margaret Spellings, over whether Chicago would be allowed to provide supplemental educational services, that is, tutoring for students in schools not making adequate yearly progress, and ultimately was granted the ability to provide those services itself. The Chicago Public Schools were. So he, you know, appeals to those who want to see a continued focus on accountability, but also there are hints that he may favor a more flexible approach when it comes to dealing with states and school districts.
Bruce Fuller, what do you make of Arne Duncan?
Well, I think point number one is that he's going to have President Obama's ear, and that's very important. There's been a lot of speculation, especially during the campaign, that health care and the economy would essentially eclipse Mr. Obama's interest in education. I think Arne Duncan's selection certainly doesn't eliminate those concerns among educators, but I think it's a very good signal that the president has picked someone who's very close to him personally and someone that Obama has respected over the years. I also think that Mr. Duncan has sort of veered in various ways during his tenure in Chicago, as Martin, I think, is indicating. He has done some controversial things, like paying kids to get better grades, which a lot of parents and teachers have looked askance at. But he definitely shows sort of a boldness to experiment and try new things and see if they work. And again, that seems to map on pretty closely to Mr. Obama's approach to governing. So he seems to be governing from the center. He's a consensus builder, but he's willing to experiment when he wants to.
Do you see Duncan, and for that matter, Barack Obama, trying to find a way to sort of build on No Child Left Behind, or you know, back away from it entirely?
Well, I think Martin framed it pretty clearly. The coalition that originally crafted No Child Left Behind essentially has disintegrated over the years. This includes moderate business activists, both in California and around the country, who want to see tougher accountability standards and more testing. It includes civil rights activists on the political left who also like testing because it shines a bright spotlight on those kids that have been left behind and ignored by urban districts. And it includes the teacher unions, who I think will battle for even more flexibility than Arne Duncan has provided in Chicago. So I think there's going to be a huge task, and that's going to be to get all these parties back around the table. They haven't been around the table in several years as support for No Child Left Behind has dwindled. But the act does have to be reauthorized. There's an urgent need to recraft the federal role to make schools more just and more fair. And it's going to be a true test of Arne Duncan's consensus-building skills, whether he can get those parties to agree on a new federal role for education.
Well, let's put the call out to listeners. What do you think about Barack Obama's pick? Where would you like to see Arne Duncan focus his efforts in the next year? Give us a call on our listener comment line, 415-553-3300. And now that you have your pen up, 415-866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. And, of course, you can always email us at forum@kqed.org. Martin West, you initially supported John McCain's bid for president. Do you think McCain would have done anything different from what Barack Obama is trying to do now?
I That's a difficult question to address because we don't know. All we know is the appointment of the Secretary of Education at this point. And I think he is someone who appeals to a lot of different camps, and he's not ultimately going to be able to please all of those camps to the same extent. So I think we run the risk of sort of projecting a particular set of views and positions on this new appointee when really, you know, as an urban superintendent, he hasn't been asked to talk exactly as to what he thinks the federal role in school accountability should be. So while we know he tends to support the use of test-based accountability to drive school improvement, we don't know what his position on the federal role is. So I think it's risky to try and speculate based on this appointment about exactly how his positions would differ from those of John, someone who would have been appointed by John McCain. One area of consistency is that Arne Duncan has been a strong supporter of charter schools, which were a core element of the McCain agenda when it came to education. He has supported charter schools in Chicago, and when he was not able to open new charter schools because of a cap on the number of schools operating, he's created very similar governance structures in some of the public schools in Chicago by giving them additional flexibilities, in some cases closing failing public schools and reopening them with new leadership with new flexibilities. So I think that's an area where you see actually consistency with something that McCain was pushing for.
Well, let's turn now to some of our listeners. Elad in San Jose.
Hi there.
Hi. What do you have to add to the discussion this morning?
Thanks for taking my call. I truly believe that everything in social justice has to do with better education. I'm a teacher myself, and I would really like to see teachers getting paid more. I would like to see more importance attached to that profession. You know, we spend so much money on prisons and so on, and I believe if we educated our kids better, we wouldn't have so many of these problems. And the other thing is we have all these brilliant minds going into business and computer science, engineering, which are not bad professions, but it would be really great to see some of our brilliant minds go into education and improve our society from that way.
Elad, let me ask you, you've mentioned pay as a big factor in certainly recruiting and retaining teachers. Can you think of anything else that would make the profession more attractive to more people?
I think society looks upon the teaching profession kind of almost condescendingly. When I told my parents I wanted to be a teacher, they would say, oh, well, how will you ever make a living? How will you ever support your family? Are you sure you want to do this? It's really hard. It's really, you know, this kind of attitude. Whereas in other countries, from what I hear in China and Japan, a teacher is a very respected profession. And when people hear that they do that, they have a lot of regard for you. And they also are paid more. And, of course, in our society, money is the thing, and that's a sign of respect. So it's not only personal respect, but also respect from the financial standpoint, which is kind of the benchmark for how valued your profession is or your work is in American society.
Thank you so much, Elad. Professor Bruce Fuller, do you think that public policy analysts need to be thinking about some kind of an ad campaign to encourage people to think of teaching as a cool profession?
Well, we definitely need better press in terms of and working, especially in urban schools. I do think the caller's bringing up an important point, which is how do we improve the quality of schools as a workplace for teachers? This was a debate leading up to this morning's appointment. We've got aggressive reformers. I call them the efficiency hawks, like Joel Klein in New York or Michelle Rhee in D.C., who are very aggressive in firing principals and trying to weed out bad teachers, whereas people on the other side of this debate are saying we're not going to make progress until schools become a more meaningful and fulfilling workplace for teachers. You know, we lose about a third to 40% of our teachers in the first 3 or 4 years of their working in schools. So I think the caller's cutting to the chase here in terms of how can Arne Duncan and how can state leaders improve the quality of schools so that people want to work in these institutions? And this is an issue with No Child Left Behind, because the No Child Law has tried to micromanage and highly regulate the work of teachers, which further drives out the best and the brightest. So it's got to be a challenge both in Washington and from Sacramento to change the nature of teaching and to make it more meaningful for a new generation of teachers.
Let's go now to Marta in Davis.
Yes, good morning. I'm fascinated with this discussion. I myself went through an experience. I was born in Argentina, and I attended a secondary school when Perón was in power, and the secondary school was a disaster. When I entered university the first year, nobody was prepared for a school. So a program was established after the dictatorship where high school students that had a degree but that they didn't have the knowledge necessary to attack the work were prepared. And the work that was done was recruiting not teachers, not people with certificates, but people with the enthusiasm, with the soul to teach and communicate the enthusiasm to the kids. So I think that that element is not taken into account in all these grandiose plans of, I think that people should be recruited from areas they are interested in teaching. They want to communicate.
Let's put that question, Marta, to, again, Bruce Fuller, since you are at UC Berkeley and you know, have history with California policy. Has that been tried, teachers without credentials, and to what extent could it be implemented to a greater extent?
Well, it's a great question, Rachel. There has been a growing debate over so-called alternative routes into teaching. Teach for America is the most well-known, perhaps, in the U.S., and some people have felt that's been a wonderful option. The evidence, these young teachers coming out of college do not go through traditional teacher training programs like we have at Berkeley or San Francisco State. They do a 5 or 6 week boot camp and then go directly into urban classrooms. It's definitely been successful in capturing a whole generation of young people coming out of colleges and universities who spend 2 or 3 years teaching. The evidence, however, is not so enthusiastic. We don't quite know whether teachers moving through these summer programs are as effective of those as those who get master's degrees. Business advocates, of course, like it because it's a more efficient way to get more teachers into the classroom. But whether those teachers stay in the profession and develop strong relationships with their students remains an open empirical question.
That question of retention. Along these lines, we've got California's Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jack O'Connell, on the phone. Superintendent, thank you for joining us.
Always nice to be with you. Thank you for calling.
What do you make of this recommendation we've just heard to try and get more teachers from alternative routes, from places, you know, maybe they start without credentials, maybe they come from other professions?
I'm very supportive of the concept of trying to create additional pathways into the teaching profession. The numbers are simply staggering in terms of the number of teachers we're going to need over the next decade, and we clearly are going to have to try to bring folks from the real world, from the private sector, that have experience, that have knowledge, bring on that real world relevancy, the applicability to our classrooms.
And what do you make of Obama's pick of Arne Duncan from Chicago?
By reputation, outstanding selection. I mean, I can't emphasize enough the importance that this position is going to have during the next couple of years. The reauthorization of the No Child Left Behind law, and we all support the goals of that, but it's in the implementation, the fact that it's been overly prescriptive, it's been a one-size-fits-all approach, and it's been significantly underfunded. But that said, it has helped us shed light on the achievement gap. It's helped us focus more time, energy, resources on many of the students that need more of our help.
Well, to move this discussion forward, let's go now to Cedar in Oakland.
Yes, hi. I'd like the callers to address the nature of the tests that we have in high-space testing, because I feel like that's a critical issue, that the discussion sort of stops short of the design of the tests, and that we all want accountability, but it makes a difference in what kind of test you're having. And I think that's another, to dovetail with the earlier caller's question about the incentives that we provide teachers and the classroom atmosphere. I think the nature of the test and what teachers are teaching to, if they're becoming very accountable to the test, the nature of the test matters a lot in terms of the classroom atmosphere. And I wonder if the discussants could talk about that a little bit.
Professor Martin West, we haven't had a chance to check in with you. What do you make of this argument? Too many standardized tests clogging the system?
The caller's argument, as I understand, is not necessarily that there are too many standardized tests, but that the standardized tests that are being used are in many cases of low quality. And I think that's certainly the case. In the rush to create state testing systems under No Child Left Behind, you have seen a lot of states take low quality, sometimes less expensive options than states that have developed standards-based assessment systems over a number of years, states like Massachusetts and South Carolina that have been sort of at the forefront of this effort and have done a better job and as a result have been able to sustain support for an agenda of standards-based reform over time. But the issue of test quality is really an important one.
Superintendent Jack O'Connell?
We need to make sure, and we're much better today than we were 5 years ago and light years better than we were 10 years ago when we embarked upon the standards-based test. And we also need to make sure that the testing is without bias, that we take into account the fact that students come from different backgrounds, that it's a bias-free test as much as possible. And that we continue to make sure that our testing is aligned to our standards. You know, all the teachers, and most of my friends are teachers, and they would say to me 5, 6, 7 years ago, look, Jack, should we be teaching to the test or should we be teaching to the standards? Well, you don't hear that anymore. Today, they are aligned. And if you want to teach to the test, great. You're simultaneously teaching to the standards. And vice versa, if you want to teach to the standards, you're at the same time preparing students to do well for the test. And last point is oftentimes we hear criticism that there's too much testing. And I can tell you it's actually less than 1% of the instructional time that our students have that's actually devoted to these requirements of the state.
Well, obviously we could go on about this topic, but we're running out of time here. So let me thank you, Jack O'Connell, for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me again.
That was Jack O'Connell, California's Superintendent of Public Instruction. Also with us this morning, Martin West, Assistant Professor of Education at Brown University and an executive editor of Education Next, a scholarly journal published by the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Martin, any last moment? Sorry, we've actually run out of time. So let me thank you again for joining us this morning.
Glad I could be here.
And also thanking Professor Bruce Fuller, a professor of education and public policy at UC Berkeley, also director of the Policy Analysis for California Education, or PACE, an independent policy research center based at UC Berkeley and Stanford University. Professor Fuller, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rachel.
Coming up next, we'll be talking with Craig Newmark of Craigslist about volunteerism under the Obama administration. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. Coming up in this half hour of Forum, President-elect Barack Obama's platform calls, among other things, for a Craigslist for service that would leverage technology to increase awareness of and participation in service opportunities. In this second half hour, we've got the Craig in Craigslist, Craig Newmark, joining us to share his vision for using technology to expand civic engagement. Craig, thank you for being here.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
So tell us about your platform as described on the Huffington Post recently.
Calling it a platform is too ambitious. I figured, well, there's that metaphor, Craigslist for service. It has nothing to do with Craigslist itself, and I'm not speaking for Craigslist right now, but it struck a chord with me, and I found that over the years I've slowly been doing more and more things to help people outside of Craigslist. By accident, I've become kind of a community organizer, so I figured I might as well expand on that, talking about what in real life might be an effective kind of quote-unquote Craigslist for service.
Presumably, the president-elect and his advisors have looked to Craigslist as an inspiration for a way to get people involved with each other.
Perhaps so. It's unclear. You know, my role with the whole Obama campaign has been microscopic. The idea is that there's a clear call for people to think about what this might be. How do we make greater service a real thing? How do we make more happen?
People are clearly, in a sense, getting together on Craigslist, talking about ideas, putting out calls for assistance, and answering them on the service. Can you give some examples of people who've sort of found a way to help each other?
Well, the best example happened with Hurricane Katrina. The deal there is that as the hurricane approached, survivors used our site, repurposed our New Orleans site, to let friends and family know where they were headed. Friends and family looked for survivors that way. And then within a couple days, people were offering housing and jobs to survivors. There we find a lot of other ways people help each other out through the list, sometimes unconventionally. I think there's been 4 kidney contributions. That's not a pure good because that contravenes the existing mechanisms for that, but it does show that people will give each other a break.
You know, this raises an interesting question in the sense that, as you point out, that there are existing programs in place, everything from 1,000 points of light, I'm thinking of from the earlier Bush days, all the way to food banks, local churches, temples, synagogues, where people have established ways of getting together to do good for others. Do you worry that if we overfocus on the digital medium, we sort of displace that energy?
I think we're getting more of that kind of helping out energy, if you want to call it that. We're seeing more of it, and we're seeing more of it focused. In a way, what's happening online is not new. However, when you do stuff online, you can potentially enlist a lot more people. Like forever, people have pooled together money to help friends or something like that, and that's worked. But your social networks in real life, offline, you know, they're limited maybe to the hundreds. But when you get something going online, you can scale that potentially to the millions. One example of that is Kiva.org, which helps people pool together money to help typically small businessmen in other countries. There's also Donors Choose, which allow people to pool money to fund classroom projects. People did that forever, but now we can do that across the country and the world, and it's working.
One of the things I found really interesting about your post on the Huffington Post was a call out to peertopatent.org, an existing program where scientists, one presumes, can help patent examiners check out new inventions.
Yeah. The idea is that there are a lot of smart people everywhere, a lot of people who will donate really high-skilled time to good things. Peer to patent, I think the principal person behind that is Beth Novick, who works out of Stanford sometime, and it's working.
Another thing you've mentioned is that it's important for people to declare themselves publicly, to sort of commit in front of others online that they're pledging to do good things. Why is it important to do that?
The problem with all this stuff is how do you get people excited about it? How do you get people to commit, and then how do you get people to follow through? Sometimes what that means is publicly declaring oneself to the community and maybe to tie it into existing social networks, whether they're offline or online, like maybe on Facebook or LinkedIn, you know, whatever the kids use or whatever.
Well, I'm going to put the call out to listeners to publicly declare what you think about volunteering in 2009 and beyond. Give us a ring on our listener line at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. And, of course, you can email us at forum@kqed.org. You know, one of the things that I've been thinking about in talking about this is my inbox is filled on a daily basis by people who are, you know, riled up about issues, forwarding articles or links to articles and saying, basically lamenting the state of things. But it seems there's a big jump to get from that state of affairs where somebody is just commenting to getting up off their seat and getting involved.
Yeah. The problem is, how do you make this kind of service a cool thing? And Barack has done some of that by issuing a call to service. How do you go beyond that? Well, I'm trying. I mean, I'm a nerd. The whole plastic pocket protector thing and thick black glasses taped together, that was really me.
Although I should mention you're wearing a suit. There's a nice jacket going on.
Well,
there.
I appreciate that. But I can dress up, but I'm still a nerd. This is more a matter for a species related to nerd called a wonk, a policy wonk. And I guess I'm starting to work with a bunch of them. They're the people who know how to make these things happen. I'm just pushing in the very modest way I can. But I'm persistent.
You're persistent. And how do you think a network sort of helps people unleash their inner policy wonk?
Well, the idea is to make this kind of thing expected and normal. And then people will start talking to each other, with each other, with what kinds of things they're doing. In the essay, I do point out that some people will want to go for a living. It will take a service job. Could be military or Peace Corps or be a teacher or a cop. Some people will dedicate a little time. Some will dedicate a little money. Frankly, I find it attractive that I can perform some kind of service without removing my backside from my chair.
Well, you raise another issue here. I mean, it's easy for us two middle-class, English as a first language individuals, professionals, to sit here and talk about civic engagement online. But something I find as a journalist is that a lot of working poor, elderly, non-English speakers, these folks are not necessarily browsing Craigslist for spare refrigerators.
Well, there's a lot of problems we're facing. One is the digital divide, although we're finding in this country it may be more of a matter between people of different ages than different ethnicities. Kids are using cell phones and internet technology to connect with each other in ways that I'm finding I'm getting too old to really understand. And I do find that it makes me sad because so much is missing me right now. Throughout the world, the digital divide, I think, is ultimately going to be addressed by cell phones. But the idea is that also there are a lot of people who need a break. They're not going to have the time to volunteer for anything, and that's realistic, and we got to remember that too.
Well, with that, let's go to listeners. I'm going to just put out the number once again to encourage you to call 866-733-6786. With questions for Craig Newmark. What do you want to ask Craig about volunteering, about service, about doing good in the world we live in? And, of course, about Craigslist. Let's turn now to Ozzy on a cell phone.
Yeah, first up, I'd love to commend Craigslist. And Craig, of course, great integral part of the Bay Area. My comment, actually, you guys just covered it, you know, is basically seconding the notion that the working class, you know, is out there, but it is so hard for so many of them just to get by. You know, it's hard for them to find the, you know, financial and time to, you know, volunteer more often.
Well, the deal is that you're right. Let's say you're a single parent trying to put a couple kids through college. You're not going to have the time or money to help out, and that's fine. The idea is we all have to have realistic expectations. The hard part will be to enlist millions of people and then throughout the world, hundreds of millions of people.
You know, it's an interesting thing. A lot of people look forward to retirement as a time when they can, you know, really give back, maybe even start on a second career that's essentially a nonprofit career, you know, picking a subject that particularly excites them. But now with the economy the way it is, I imagine a lot of people have to scale down their ambitions.
Well, a lot of people are learning to live better within their means. A lot of people, though, still see that other people need a break more. People are pretty good. I mean, the number of, let's say, predators out there is very, very tiny. And people are happy to give each other a break.
Well, let's turn now to Jason in Oakland.
Hi, guys. Thanks for letting me on. And I was really excited to hear about all this on the radio today because I volunteer with a coalition of nonprofit groups in Oakland who are helping with Oakland's climate action plan. And I'm a career coach myself, and so I'm helping to put together, this coalition will be launching a website January 1st that allows people to volunteer for this climate action plan.
That so how does that work, Jason?
Well, it'll start out very simple. It'll be wiki pages where people list the topics of their professional experience, and they can list what environmental topics they're especially interested in helping out with and how many hours a week that they can volunteer. And then the many nonprofit groups that are helping with the Climate Action Plan can review that, contact those people. We were actually going to have folks post their resumes on Craigslist so that groups could really look at their resumes. And that will put that'll help the nonprofit groups who need the volunteers, and also people who want to transition into green careers. This allows them to get that kind of topic experience.
You start volunteering, you end up getting a paycheck off of something you love.
Well, a lot of people, a lot of people are working out things where they can do something, and they can do something of service to others, and actually make a job of it, a career of it, that might not be conventional. Now, a problem with so many good efforts going on is that maybe there's too many of them, and there's the risk that we're going to get a little fatigue regarding this. That's why I am trying to point out and find what are the umbrella organizations that are making a lot of this happen together. Volunteer Match is very good along those lines. And again, when it comes to microfinance, Kiva, which is based in San Francisco, is really good. And as soon as we can get a certain announcement approved, I'll be stepping up my own activities in microfinance, particularly those for Israeli-Palestinian serious business and eventually peace.
So I guess we're hearing this here first on Forum?
Well, I've talked about before how, frankly, I was inspired by the Marshall Plan after World War II. That was a great expression of, good American values. Plus, it helped build markets and prevented a lot of extremism. Mundane, but got a lot of results.
There's certainly no lack of opportunities to engage in an effort. Let's turn now to Red in Sacramento.
Hi. How are you this morning?
Good.
Listen, I just wanted to make a comment that there is a line, there is a place at which the line of national service and the line of volunteerism intersect. And I've been working on a proposal for a long time. I'll leave many blank spaces. But basically it is that if we had a national service program in which people were put to volunteering and contributing in essential items for our society, energy, food, transportation, information, education, those kinds of things, housing, and earned credit toward being taken care of in these items in any time in their life that they needed them, we could actually do away with welfare and poverty by enlisting people in national service. They would actually be earning these, you know, it would be a paid-for program in which if somebody, you know, worked in one of, say, two or three of these fields for 4 years or something at the beginning of their career life, at the, you know, when they got out of high school, they might actually, you know, we might actually allow people to earn their safety net
before they
enter full citizenship. So that's where national service and volunteerism might come together, and that's a very forward-looking program. I'm leaving a lot of gaps.
Understood. Thank you, Red. And you know, it's an idea that other countries have taken up. I'm thinking of Canada for one. Craig, have you seen a lot of response from international folks reading your blog posting, or for that matter, you know, talking with other people on Craigslist?
Well, I do read some of the comments regarding the little thing I put up on Huffington Post yesterday. And I do know people are talking about national service as a way for people to give back to our society at the beginning of their careers, or as maybe a means of employment. We do have this big economic issue going on. It could kind of like be under FDR in the 30s, where people do real stuff to help out, and that helps everyone out, both in infrastructure and in stimulating the economy.
So killing two birds with one stone, in a way.
A lot's happening here. A lot of people who are much smarter than I am are talking about that kind of thing. As odd as it sounds, my role seems to be pointing out what's going on and to push it harder. Again, as a nerd, I would prefer to be smarter than I'm currently being, but that's the value I can add.
You sort of bring together collective intelligence. Along those lines, we're looking for your collective intelligence. Give us a ring at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Let's go now to Peter in Berkeley.
Hi. Hi, Craig. What are your recommended techniques for a small charity to get started getting more volunteers and donors, especially getting tech help if they're currently technically challenged? There's so many things out there, it's a little overwhelming just to pick and choose. So what is your recommendation?
Overall, I'm not the best person to recommend that, although we have this Craigslist Foundation, which does have a lot about that, including having these nonprofit boot camps, which address a lot of those issues specifically.
How do you go about training nonprofit officials or executives or volunteers who just don't even know where to begin?
Well, what the folks the serious workers in the foundation, and frankly, my role is glamorous figurehead, but the day is one of classes which address the serious needs of nonprofits, the hard stuff. Just in my own observation, a lot of people running nonprofits don't know how to articulate what they're about briefly and to the point. Because even in the nonprofit world, you got to give what people in the internet industry call a elevator speech. You got to be able to talk about what your nonprofit is in about 45 seconds, and then you got to start getting the word out. And normally when trying to get the word out, the use of one's social networks, offline and online, are pretty effective. But, of course, in this case, you're trying to get people online, and that's a separate problem to begin with. I got to work on that with my mother.
I think I could think of a lot of people we could work with it on. Let's look for a contrarian viewpoint from Janet in San Mateo.
Hi. Do you consider that people are already putting tens of billions of dollars of volunteer work into this country, and that more volunteer work actually puts a significant number of people out of paying jobs.
And how does that work, Janet?
Well, you introduce new people doing volunteer work, right, that some people are doing today for money.
So, okay, for instance, volunteering in schools, perhaps, the school district might say, well, we don't have to hire as many teachers?
Or teachers' aides or whatnot.
Well, I'd have to challenge the assumption. I'm not aware of people in voluntary positions displacing people in paid positions. I'd like to hear more about that because there needs to be some kind of balance there. Right now, education is one of the toughest things humans do, and to get some extra volunteers in classrooms helping kids read or do arithmetic, that seems like a pure win to me, but maybe this is an area I don't know enough about. And, my email address is craig@craigslist.org. That's really me there.
And I'm going to put out our email address, forum@kqed.org. We are reading our emails, so feel free to send those in. You know, Craig, it raises an interesting point that nonprofits can use the internet to come together to discuss and argue over what's the most effective way to get the message out, to employ people, to make what they do more effective.
Yeah. Well, right now, a lot of nonprofit organizations are using the net smarter and smarter. Beyond the obvious, people are just using a simple mailing list where people discuss at their leisure what's going on with their group and how they need to do more. I live near, I live up on the, kind of on the hills around UCSF and everything, where people are clearing paths through the forest there, and people are using mailing lists to move that ahead because, I want to start taking the occasional hike through there. I know that would mean I would have to remove my backside from my chair, but even I'm willing to do that once in a while.
Well, I said we were going to take emails, and so we are. Here's somebody who sort of follows along that last comment that we were hearing, who says, I'm afraid this idea of a Craigslist for services based on volunteering will weaken further the lack of a tax-based solid government services. We may volunteer in emergencies, but we need a tax-empowered government to deliver a reliable and accountable service for the rest of the time. So in other words, the idea that by sort of helping to fill in the blanks, we let the government lapse on what it should be doing with our tax dollars.
Good point. In that case, I just wasn't clear. This idea that I'm putting forward complements the existing programs that the Obama team are pushing. The idea is that we're talking about an expanded Peace Corps, an expanded AmeriCorps. There's a lot of things that people are expanding on in terms of full-time service that that's moving ahead. So I guess I just wasn't clear in all that, and I'll need to be in the future. I should add, too, that we need to treat people who have performed services for others. We need to treat them better when they're done. I'm actually involved with the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. And, you know, the current administration has not treated returning veterans or their families very well. So the idea is that not only do we need to promote this kind of paid full-time service, but treat people well, especially if they're coming home wounded.
You have to think about the follow-up as well as the initial elevator pitch.
Yeah, and I'll have more to announce along those lines in the near future.
Well, with that said, let's turn now to Darlene in Marin.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much.
So, Darlene, go ahead.
I'm calling from the Center for Volunteer and Nonprofit Leadership in Marin, and we're both a nonprofit support center and a volunteer center here in our county. And we do have some programs that engage skilled older adults in service, and what they really do is help to augment a lack of resources in the nonprofit community and assist executive directors and anywhere from, you know, strategic planning, some fundraising, consultation, marketing, things like that.
Taking advantage of their professional experience.
That's right. And the majority of the folks that are on this team with us, it's called the Civic Engagement Leadership Team, are retired professionals, and they have a wealth of experience. And really, what we see is there's a lack of resources in the nonprofit community to do everything that they really want to do and need to do to move their mission forward. And so augmenting your resources with volunteers, especially the skilled group of volunteers, is a way for them to better serve the community.
Thank you, Darlene. You know, Craig, Darlene raises an interesting point here that people come in with new ideas, and those new ideas may require getting out checkbooks to make them happen.
Well, that's right. The idea is that people will need to volunteer both time and money for a lot of these efforts. And I'd like to see a lot of this coalesce among some places where people can actually connect with each other. Thinking out loud, in addition to Craigslist Foundation, again, Volunteer Match might be a good place for some of that to happen. It is not a perfect fit for what we were just talking about, but it's the beginning of something. Because, again, right now there's a lot of people doing a lot of good stuff and people don't know about each other. That's true of me, too. I have barely an idea of what's going on.
Somehow I failed to believe that. But with that said, let's turn now to Christina in Sacramento.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me on. And thank you, Craig, for all your amazing website and everything that you do for the community. I was calling because I work in the City of Sacramento Office of Youth Development. And one issue that I'm constantly encountering is that there's a lack of places for teenagers to find jobs, and there's not a central information source for youth to do that. And I've actually written your foundation and your community services to encourage you to include a youth employment page where employers post job opportunities and internship opportunities for youth.
So that sounds like an elevator pitch right here on the air, Craig.
It is, and actually it would also be a form of a way for employers to be more engaged with the community by offering employment and internship opportunities for youth, which now if they want to do that, they can't because it's hard to recruit the youth and post that information.
Okay. Yeah, right now we have a little bit of that, things heading in that direction. There must be something that can be better done, either through the main website or maybe something through the foundation. This is an area where I don't have enough expertise to come up with a really bright idea, but you know how to find me.
Craigslist.
And I'll just put youth employment in the subject.
Yeah. Again, it's not an area of my expertise, but at least I can keep the idea alive. At some point, someone a lot smarter than me will come up with the right idea. I bet it's not going to be me.
So now, Craig, you've obviously alluded to a website where people can start their search. Any other websites you want to get into as we roll to a close here to get people started looking online?
Well, there's a range of them for different purposes right now. There's nothing that comes together real cleanly. What I'm doing is looking at specific successes, people which act as umbrella sites for a lot of good stuff. I've mentioned Donors Choose and Kiva and Volunteer Match. And what we're doing also is trying to find sites where people commit to doing something good for others and then helps them follow through, because the following through part is pretty difficult. Along those lines, the Clinton Global Initiative started mycommitments.org. There's a few others mentioned in my piece yesterday. And there are some people who are just thinking on a small basis, how do you enlist your friends to help out? It's just a start.
Craig Newmark, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You'll find his blog on Huffington Post. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Thank you for joining us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.